Presents the Tom Hartman Program, Truth in Broadcasting.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. This tragic bombing in Iraq of the soccer fans, many saying now this is the final straw, the proverbial camel's back for the possibility of a reconciliation between Shia and Sunni in Iraq. Let's hope not, but not a good situation at all. And of course, Alberto Gonzalez, now the Senate giving him a few days to decide whether he's going to change his testimony or they're going to consider going after him as, you know, possibly perjury charges. A lot happening in the news. We will be getting to as we go throughout the day. The larger frame, though, is what's happening as a consequence of Iraq, what's happening as a consequence of, for example, the Gonzalez testimony yesterday. What's happening to our Constitution? What's happening to this constitutionally limited representative democratic republic in which we live? Bob Barr is with us. He was the congressman from the 7th District of Georgia, the U.S. House of Representatives from 1995 to 2003. He occupies the 21st Century Liberties Chair for Freedom and Privacy at the American Conservative Union. He's a member of the Constitution Project's Initiative on Liberty and Security, president and CEO of Liberty Strategies, LLC, a public policy consulting firm headquartered in Atlanta, Georgia, with offices in Washington, D.C. And he had been a United States attorney, for those who have been following that whole issue, the Northern District of Georgia, 1986 to 1990, appointed by President Ronald Reagan. Congressman Bob Barr, welcome to the program.
Tom, it's great to be with you. It's been too long since we've shared a little time together, and I really appreciate the opportunity to be with you and your many, many listeners today.
Well, thank you for coming back on. We had a couple of great conversations at the CPAC conference, and I guess it was almost 3 years ago that the first time that you and I did an in-depth conversation for, as I recall, it was either public radio or Canadian Broadcasting, but one of those. It's good to have you back with us. I'd like to get there's a series of things that I'd like to get into with you today in some depth. And the first is, why is it that these issues about the assault on the Constitution, and frankly, there have been assaults on the Constitution from both sides of the aisle over the last 200 years at various times, and Democrats are, you know, bear some complicity in many of these more recently, things like the Military Commissions Act. Why is it that it is so often represented in the media and, frankly, by the parties as a partisan issue when it really should be, at least in my opinion, I believe in yours, an American issue?
It certainly should not be partisan, and unfortunately, both of the two major parties, the Republican far more than the Democrat Party these days, use it as a political football and use it to perpetuate either themselves in power, to get legislation passed, to get appropriations approved or whatnot. What's happening is, you know, sort of like, I don't know if you recall the movie Back to the Future with Michael J. Fox a number of years ago, but he had this photograph of he and his family, and after he'd gone back in time, the figures on it slowly started to disappear. And that's what's happening to our Bill of Rights. Our civil liberties, including our precious right to privacy, which to me is the most fundamental of all of them, are disappearing before our very eyes. And it's the result of several things. One is the ignorance on the part of the American public as to these important civil liberties. Secondly, almost an irrational fear of another terrorist attack, which provides a justification for increasing government power. And thirdly, the unabashed way, the unashamed way our political leaders, particularly this administration, are playing on people's fears to increase government power. That's what this boils down to.
Yeah, indeed it does. And let's refer to the Democratic Party by its real name, the Democratic Party, if you don't mind. You said the Democrat Party, and there's no such thing.
Oh,
so just
no.
Forgive my little OCD here, but But spot on and well said. And a number of your colleagues, and we had Bruce Fine on the other day, and who is a conservative and openly calling for the impeachment of George W. Bush and Dick Cheney. And he mentioned you in a breath in which he named a number of other conservatives who he said were very, very concerned about the direction that this administration is going. What do you think is the remedy, and to what extent do you think that this is coming exclusively out of a small cabal of neoconservatives and their water carriers in the administration versus something larger and more systemic?
It is larger and more systemic, but of course the driving force over the past 7 years has been, or 6 years, 6.5 years, has been this administration, and in particular the vice president and the neocons that have worked their way after about a generation or two of trying into the top echelons of power in our government. But the problem is much larger. What needs to be done are several things. One, we need to take advantage of the new leadership in the Congress, particularly people like Senator Leahy, chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, who are now in positions to actually conduct meaningful oversight hearings, inquiring into the goings-on at the Department of Justice that you just mentioned a few minutes ago, the illicit, unlawful surveillance of American citizens by this administration using the National Security Agency, because that's our most immediate defense against what's going on, to go to the Congress and get them, now that the Democrats are in a majority and not beholden to this administration, to change the laws and change the appropriations and hold people's feet to the fire. Certainly there are court cases that are pending, some of which have been brought by the ACLU, which deserve our support, and which organization deserves our support. But those, as you know, take a long time. They move forward by fits and starts. And we also have to work through the political structure to get people into positions of power at all levels of government who actually believe and support the Constitution, like you do and like Bruce Fine, for example, that you mentioned does.
Yeah, and I believe you do. And you were one of the floor leaders for the impeachment of Bill Clinton. Would you support the impeachment of George W. Bush?
I would support an inquiry into these matters to really hone the issues. The FISA issue, to me, Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which this administration has deliberately ignored and flouted, to me is among the most serious potential grounds for an impeachment. There certainly are others, but misusing, violating our laws, the grounds on which we move forward with the impeachment of the former president were the violation of other federal laws, those against perjury and obstruction of justice, and the laws that protect the privacy of American citizens against government surveillance are certainly at least as important as those others.
I would submit that they're far more important.
I think they are.
I'd be surprised if you disagreed with me on that. In the Financial Times, there's an article, the headline, Support for Terror Falls in Muslim Countries. And this is really quite striking. They said, Edward Luce writing, he says, there's been a striking decline in support for terrorism in Muslim countries over the past 5 years. Of the 16 majority Muslim countries included in the survey, 15 have showed waning enthusiasm for terrorism in general and suicide terrorism in particular. Most striking decline in Lebanon. Similar decline in Pakistan. In Pakistan, 5 years ago, 33% of people said that they supported Osama bin Laden and suicide bombings. That's down to 9%. In Jordan, it's gone from 43 to 23%, and support for bin Laden's down to 5%. The only Arab Muslim country that still supports terrorism in this Pew study is the Palestinians, and tragically. In Turkey, support has dropped from 15% to 5% since 2000. Isn't this a symptom of the fact that possibly the Arab world is getting it, that 9/11 was a criminal act and a one-off, and they're rejecting this larger rubric of a war on terror, and they're the bad guys and we're the good guys, and all this polarization?
I think it is, Tom, very significant. Many of these countries, such as Lebanon, such as, of course, Saudi Arabia, they have become, in recent years, victims themselves of very serious terrorist attacks. And I think they and their citizenry is realizing that terrorists have no place either in their society or in ours. And if you condone it, condone the use of terrorism against one particular enemy in a particular country, sooner or later it's going to come a cropper, as we say here in the South, and it's going to affect you directly. And that's what we see happening in a lot of these Arab countries. And yet our policies, while in some respects support these governments and what they're trying to do, overall our policies are not oriented primarily towards supporting the governments in these countries that are coming to realize and sufficiently supporting them. Instead, we're focusing so much of our attention on the occupation of Iraq, which is not really helping.
Yeah, it's very definitely not. And this whole rubric of the war on terror, I cringe every time I hear it. But we'll get back to that. And I also want to get into your and the conservative vision of America and where it's at these days and where it's going. We're talking with former Congressman Bob Barr of Georgia. We'll be at BobBarr.com or BobBarr.org, rather, his website. 17 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here on Air America Radio.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us. This is Air America Radio.
Indeed, it's time to take our country back. Frankly, on both sides, I would like to see, you know, honest conservatives of integrity take back the Republican Party and honest liberals of integrity take back the Democratic Party, and let's put this country back on track. We're talking with Congressman Bob Barr. BobBarr.org is website. Former U.S. Congressman representing the 7th District of Georgia, now occupies the 21st Century Liberties Chair for Freedom and Privacy at the American Conservative Union, member of the Constitution Project's Initiative on Liberty and Security, and CEO of Liberty Strategies. He was also a U.S. attorney in the Northern District of Georgia, appointed by President Reagan 1986 to 1990. Congressman Bob Barr, the conservative vision of America, corporatization of Social Security, corporatization of education or privatization, whatever you want to call it, shrinking government, getting it out. A lot of this originated as a backlash to Soviet communism. And I was in Russia when it was part of the Soviet Union. I was in East Berlin when it was East Berlin. And, you know, clearly communism didn't work. It was a horrible and destructive thing. But the European countries have demonstrated that the middle way, like France with national health care and guaranteed, you know, unemployment insurance and things, that it seems to work. How does the conservative vision of America change in the face of the demonstrated success of this kind of middle path or this arguably liberal path in Europe?
Well, I'm not quite sure I would describe the socialized medicine approach or socialized education approach in a lot of the European countries as a middle path. To me, it's a big government path. Certainly not a communistic system, but a big government path nonetheless. I approach it from what I consider a true conservative standpoint, and I'm very active formally now with the Libertarian Party and its work to try and get, you know, the whole range of these issues back into the private sector so that the individual is empowered as opposed to the state, empowered to deliver education and to provide health care and so forth. I look, for example, at, and I travel probably not as much as you, but I do travel over to Europe and other parts of the world, and I don't find that that their healthcare systems are demonstrably better than ours because the government is running them. In some respects, I continue to believe, based on my own experiences, that our healthcare system is far better than these systems, because you do have much more personal choice. You do.
Well, here's the big difference, though. I lived in Germany for a year. I've worked in Europe for on and off almost 30 years. In fact, I'll be back there in another month and a half. And nobody in Europe goes bankrupt because of medical expenses. It doesn't happen. Yet that's 50% of all bankruptcies in the United States. We have 18,000 people a year dying in the United States of preventable illnesses because they didn't get early care because they didn't have health insurance or they didn't get any care at some point. People are actually terrified in the United States of illness. And in Europe, there is no terror of illness beyond that of the illness itself. That's a really huge difference.
Well, it may be a difference in some ways, but I don't think you can look at it in a vacuum. I think it's very relevant, Tom, to look at the tax rates in Europe and in Canada, which are much higher than here. Americans are terrified also of much higher tax rates, as they should
be. I don't think so.
Well,
I don't think so.
I earn my money, you earn your money, and I think you have a much higher and more profound right to that money than the government does, than some other people who.
But I disagree. Respectfully, sir, I disagree. I use public education. I use it in the employees that I
and
I think I should pay for it.
A much larger share of your money to the government. You're not limited by the tax rates. You know, if you think it's so great to, you know, have your money used for somebody else's health care or somebody else's education, you know, you have that right.
Yeah.
I don't particularly like that.
You want to see the Republican Party move in a more libertarian direction? Is that, in your mind, an optimal thing?
You know, I'd like to see government itself, both parties, I would like to see move in a libertarian direction to truly reduce the power of government and increase the way it was intended to be, the power of the individual. That's what I'd like to see. And unfortunately, the system is so stacked against a third party that it's very difficult. But I'm trying. I'm very, very happy to be with the Libertarian Party.
Interesting. Okay, great conversation. Congressman Bob Barr, bobbarr.org, the website. Thank you again for dropping by the program.
Thanks very much, Tom.
Good talking with you. 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 866-303-2270. Our telephone number, airamerica.com and tomhartman.com. The website.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Four minutes past the hour. Well, it's interesting that somebody who, a libertarian like Bob Barr, calling for an investigation into the possibility of the impeachment of George W. Bush and Dick Cheney, representing arguably the, I don't want to say the far right is like a slapdown, but representing the right, and I suppose I'm probably representing what is referred to as the far left, although frankly I think it's the mainstream of America. You know, the vast majority of Americans are willing to pay more taxes if it means that they get free health care. Well, obviously they're paying for it in their taxes, but, you know, if they have absolute guaranteed health care, period, for example. But in any case, we can disagree about how government should be run, but absolutely agree on these foundational principles of the Bush administration has overstepped dramatically, that the Constitution is being shredded, that the rights guaranteed by the First, Fourth, Fifth, Sixth, 7th, and 8th Amendments to the Constitution, arguably the 9th Amendment of the Constitution, are being, and even the 10th Amendment of the Constitution of states, are being frayed, and that this is a disastrous policy in the Middle East. I find this, just quite startling when they, Pew study. The survey found a similar trend when asked Muslims whether they had confidence in Osama bin Laden. Almost everywhere, there has been a sharp decline in affirmative responses, with Jordan showing the biggest fall from 56% in 2002 down to 20% now. In Turkey, support for Osama bin Laden is down to 5%. Now, is that because we're bombing Iraq? No. It's because the rest of the world, and frankly, I think the entire rest of the world, is saying, okay, 9/11, if 9/11 had been handled appropriately, if George W. Bush had handled 9/11 the way that Bill Clinton handled the Oklahoma City bombing, by saying, we've got a small group of crazy people led by an insane person, apparently, who have committed a horrible and egregious, a terrible crime in the United States of America. And where did that word homeland come? Don't get me started on the Nazi roots of the word homeland. But they have created this horrible crime here in the United States. And we are going to join with other countries in the world and Interpol, the International Police Organization. And we are going to find these people and we are going to give them a fair and impartial trial in front of the entire world, just like just like they did in Nuremberg, just like Bill Clinton did with Tim McVeigh, where they can defend themselves and they can bring witnesses forward. If they want to say that they didn't do it, fine. Let's find out who did. And if they are the guys who did this, they are going to go to jail for the rest of their lives. Or, for those who are gung-ho for the death penalty, I'm not. I'm an opponent of the death penalty. But, as Tim McVeigh was put to death, so be it. If that's the law of the land, that's the law of the land. But the bottom line is then the victims of 9/11 would have closure. The world could breathe a collective sigh of relief, and we could have gone on about our business. But George W. Bush instead, and Dick Cheney, and this small group of neoconservatives within the Republican Party, perhaps a large group, decided instead to use this as their Pearl Harbor incident to fundamentally rewrite our Constitution, to fundamentally change our foreign policy, and turn America into something that just very much does not look like America any longer, in many regards. And what's happening now is that Americans are starting to say, enough already, we're going to push back. We are pushing back. And thank God the Senate is. Chuck Schumer, just about 45 minutes ago, holding a press conference, he and three other senators, Dianne Feinstein, where's my list here? Dianne Feinstein, Russ Feingold, Sheldon Whitehouse, and Chuck Schumer wrote a letter to the Solicitor General, Paul Clement, asking him to appoint a special counsel to investigate Gonzalez on perjury charges. And this is just symptomatic of the larger cancer throughout this administration. Chuck Schumer.
Earlier this week, Attorney General Gonzalez testified before the Judiciary Committee, and his inability to answer simple and straightforward questions was just stunning. The Attorney General took an oath to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. Instead, he tells the half-truth, the partial truth, and everything but the truth.
And then Schumer goes on to point out that they've got it in black and white, and he lists the specific lies that Gonzalez told, and he said, enough is enough. And good on you. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Steve in Lawrenceville, New Jersey. Hey, Steve, welcome to the program.
Yeah, hi, Tom. Amen to your previous points. One thing that Bob Barr said, among others, that really drove me up the wall when you asked him, when he was talking about, when you spoke about the middle ground and socialized, so-called socialized medicine or state-run. I mean, you know, you got to give me a break because doesn't he have as a former member of the House of Representatives and all government people, don't they have all the free top medical benefits?
No, what they get, actually, as members of Congress, and Bernie Sanders filled us in on this a couple of years ago, what they get is the ability to buy one of several top-flight insurance programs. Bernie has Blue Cross Blue Shield, for example. But, you know, basically they're getting the same benefits that, you know, a typical $150,000 a year executive, which is their pay range that they have, executive in a, you know, middle management executive at IBM or Hewlett Packard or something like that would get.
Okay, so what they're saying then is that that's an employer contributed match or some such.
That's right.
So they're paying only a percentage of it, not the full amount.
Yeah, well, they're not paying any of it. I believe that it's provided to them as a perk.
That's my point. Okay.
I frankly don't remember how much if they're paying some portion of it, how much it is.
Okay, but the rest of us don't have that. That's number one. Number two is...
Well, some of us do. I mean, and I'm not one of the some of us. I mean, I pay about half of my health insurance bill. That you know, my I have health insurance through Clue Channel. But I'm telling you, you know, the people who are making $200,000, $300,000, $500,000, $1 million, $2 million a year, in probably the vast majority of cases, their employer or the corporation that they control is paying all of their health insurance.
Okay, I got you. Now let's take it a step further, okay? Let's talk about that state thing and how it affects the economy. Alright, so we get taxed a little more. But what happens then is manufacturers and employers then, correct me if I'm wrong because you spent more time in Europe than I have, but correct me if I'm wrong, if the state is picking that up, then you don't have to worry about what General Motors has to do and other corporations in this country with this huge nut for retirees and medical benefits for their employees.
Both programs, the pension programs, and they're true pension programs in most European countries, where you are guaranteed a particular income for the rest of your life, and it's adjusted for inflation, as opposed to a 401k type program where you've got a certain number of dollars, and if you live longer than you expected to, you run out of money. Which is what we're shifting over to in the United States.
Right.
They have true pensions, but they're run by the government, so you don't have people skimming money off the top. It's more like Social Security, which is a true pension. And they have true single-payer, it varies from country to country, but by and large, most of them, single-payer health care insurance programs where the government writes the checks, and you have private doctors and private hospitals in many cases. You know, it varies from country to country.
So now what you have then is the overhead of labor in those countries, even though, like, say, in Germany, they're paid on an hourly wage at least as much as we get.
It's just a given in those countries, Steve. It's just a given in those countries. It's paid for by corporate taxes. It's paid for by individual taxes. It's paid for by value added taxes. It's just built into the tax structure, by and large, in most of these countries. Again, everybody does it in some small variation of the way, but it makes their businesses more competitive. It prevents people from being terrified of disasters striking them. I mean, you know, it's just a good thing. It's just a fundamentally good thing. Steve, thanks for the call. Sharon in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Sharon, about a half a minute here before we got to take a break. What's up?
Okay, Tom, good morning. What I wanted to say real quickly was one of the points a previous guest made that is always astonishing to me, and one of the fundamental differences between Democrats and the Libertarians and Republicans. He asked if you wanted to be paying for other people's education and other people's health care. And the answer for Democrats is yes.
Yes, that was my answer.
Is no.
That's right. And Michael Moore makes this point so elegantly in his movie Sicko, and it is such a brilliant movie where he, right toward the end of the movie, he said, we have to decide in America, and I'm paraphrasing from memory here, I may be, off a few words, but basically he said, we have to decide in America whether our country is a me society or a we society. And it was just absolutely brilliant. Sharon, thank you very much for the call. 45 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you on Air America Radio. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Some amazing stuff going on in the U.S. and world economy, by the way, that might give all of us some pause to reconsider the direction this country's headed. We'll be talking about that at the top of the hour, taking your calls right after this break. Stick around.
truth in broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
I got a letter from old George W. It said, son, I hate to trouble you, but this war of mine is going bad. It's time for me to roll those dice. I know you've already been there twice, but I am sending you back to Baghdad. George W. told the nation, this is not an escalation. This is just a surge toward victory. Just to win my little war, I'm sending 20,000 more to help me save Iraq from Iraqis. And so I made it to Iraq in time for one more sneak attack. Into my old battalion I was sent. We'd drive around in our Humvees, listening to the Black Eyed Peas and speaking fondly of our president. George W. told the nation, this is not an escalation. This is just a surge toward victory.
And unfortunately, one more lie from the Bushies. 9 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. By the way, David Corton, old friend and author of When Corporations Rule the World and a whole bunch of other just great books, davidcorton.org, his website, The Great Turning, his most recent book, sent me a note yesterday. He said, per the debate that I was having with, I don't remember who it was now, actually we have this debate on a fairly regular basis, one of our conservative guests about whether corporations can pay taxes. There's this whole op-ed, a huge op-ed in today's Wall Street Journal, arguing that corporations don't pay taxes and should not pay taxes, that there should be no corporate income tax. This is the next big push, because they just pass it along to their customers, or they just pass it along to their employees, or, you know, they just pass it along to stockholders. David says, fine, if they let's just change it so that the corporations don't pay any corporate income tax. Instead, do it like sort of like sub-S corporations, so that 100% of the profit that the corporation shows at the end of the year, for example, ExxonMobil just showed a $10 billion profit. So if you own a share of ExxonMobil, your portion of that $10 billion profit is now taxable income to you. You get taxed on it. And just pass the taxes along to all the shareholders. Of course, they would hiss. They would all of a sudden get hysterical. But that is the logical endpoint of this bizarre logic that these folks are putting out. So anyhow, I thought that was great. Thank you, David. Marcella in Miami, Florida. Hey, Marcella, welcome to the program. Marcella?
Oh, hi, Tom. You are my favorite talk show host.
Thank you.
One thing I want to tell you, the conversation with the Senator Bob Barr, I think you should mention to him we pay enough high taxes if we can spend all the most of the taxes on making bombs, tanks, and bullets, and everything else. I call it offense spending, not defense spending. Maybe we could have better free medical insurance for medical for everybody. Also, you know, we have enough money to kill. We have enough money to heal.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Marcel, and that's very, very well said. Bob Barr would say, actually, I don't want to put words in his mouth. Libertarians would say, well, let's, you know, if we reduce defense spending, which we probably should, then let's just put that money in our pockets, and certainly big time in the pockets of millionaires and billionaires. Scott in Imperial Beach, California, listening on KLSD. Hey, Scott.
Hey, Tom. Good show again, as always.
Thank you.
I got a question, and maybe you can help me figure it out. Perjury is a serious thing. But apparently, it's not as serious, or it's handled differently before Congress, before the Senate, in the case of Gonzalez, than it is before a jury in the judicial system. Because, in essence, Alberto Gonzalez is getting a makeover, not a makeover, but a do-over, you know, to revise
right.
his testimony.
Yes.
Well, what's the difference in how perjury is viewed in the two venues?
The Senate thinks of itself as a very collegial body that is very cordial and very formal and very, you know, kind of left over from the House of Lords-ish. And therefore, and if somebody, particularly somebody representing the power elite of this country, comes before them and says something and puts their foot in their mouth, they should have an opportunity to correct it rather than there being gotchas.
Okay,
now,
so
I can tell you that, that Joe McCarthy didn't subscribe to that.
Well,
there have been, you know, there are ebbs and flows of this over the years in the United States. But, you know, that's and that's what Pat Leahy was saying last night. He was saying, you know, we'll give him a couple of days to correct his testimony if he wants. We're going to give him every benefit of the doubt. And in a way, frankly, it's kind of a cool thing because what they're saying is we'll give him as much rope as he wants. But once he's got all that rope, we're going to hang him with it.
Yeah, but another way to look at it, in a court of law, perjury is a lie. Before the Senate, perjury is a terminological inexactitude.
Well, only for a couple of days. And that's the distinction, Scott. Thanks for calling and pointing it out, though. By the way, Bill O'Reilly is being investigated for making death threats against Hillary Clinton. And apparently now, you know, Bill O'Reilly, the guy who has in his attacks against the Daily Kos, is asserting that if it says it on your message board, then you said it. And so over on Bill O'Reilly's message board, somebody's suggesting a terrorist attack against the U.S. Capitol building. So apparently Bill O'Reilly's also promoting terrorist attacks against the U.S. Capitol building. It's getting very, very strange. Bill O'Reilly, of course, the guy who,
So all those clowns over at the liberal radio network, we could incarcerate them immediately. Will you have that done, please? Send over the FBI and just put them in chains?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. O'Reilly. Michael in Seattle. Hey, Michael.
Good morning. Love your show, Tom. Bill O'Reilly is the biggest clown of them all. However, I was listening to – oh, and kudos real quick. Kudos to Chuck Schumer about trying to get the special counsel.
Yes, we should all be calling his office and Feinstein's office and White House's office. Yes. Absolutely.
Believe me, I'm calling him every single day from the toll-free number, Capitol Hill switchboard number I heard on your program. But real quick, two things. Barr, I couldn't agree with him more about his position on the constitutional restrictions that this Bush administration has done. And the thing is about taxes, complaining about taxes, if you add up the total tax burden that Americans pay from the federal level to the state level to the county and municipal levels, our tax burden is very much equal to what European countries are paying, and we're getting
We're getting bupkis for it. Yeah, good point, Michael. And you know what that conversation with Bob Barr really highlights is that here you've got two guys who are absolutely on opposite sides of a whole lot of political issues in the United States, and yet absolutely agree that this administration and these neoconservatives are destroying the Constitution of the United States. I think that's a healthy conversation for democracy. 57 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us. This is Air America Radio. Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Welcome to the Democracy Zone.
Welcome back. Our question for the hour, are conservative economics and the possible disastrous consequences of conservative economics as contagious as apparently obesity is? Now, I recall a couple of weeks ago, we were talking about healthcare, and a woman called in and talked about the struggle to, you know, her struggle with weight, and that this was a medical condition and that it was causing her problems. And the next caller called and said, well, I fast, and I made some comment about how, yeah, back when I was a kid, I used to fast. And I've thought about that several times since that conversation, that I rather glibly kind of skipped over the whole issue of how this is really a serious issue. And this is a really difficult thing for people who are confronting it. And I want to just absolutely acknowledge that clinical obesity, it's a real challenge. In today's New York Times, an article based on a study published in the New England Journal of Medicine, which will be in the next issue that's coming out in next week, They looked at 12,067 people over a 32-year period. And they looked at what they were eating. They looked at what diseases they had. They looked at their health conditions. They looked at all these different factors and variables. And they looked at social factors and variables, who they were friends with, who they were related to, where they were living, what they were doing. And what they found was absolutely startling, that if somebody became friends with somebody who was overweight or obese, then that person's chances of becoming obese increased by 57%. There was no effect at all when a neighbor gained weight. No effect at all when family members, or a very small effect, when family members gained weight. But when friends did, and they didn't even have to be friends that were seen regularly. They could be friends on the other side of the country that are only visited periodically. But just somebody that a person identifies with very strongly, if that person is or becomes very, very overweight, then people tend to become more overweight. This is really quite startling. From the New York Times, it did not matter if the friend was hundreds of miles away, the influence remained, and the greatest influence of all was between close mutual friends. Thus, if one became obese, the other had a 171% increased chance of becoming obese, too. Why would this be? First of all, by the way, there's some blowback on this. They're an organization, the National Association to Advance Fat Acceptance, NAAFA, has sent out a press release saying, we believe that this report indicates that thin people tend to exclude fat people from their social networks, and now proves that there's social discrimination against people of size. We believe that this report encourages even further discrimination against fat people. Could be. But I've looked at a good chunk of this study, and the methodology seems fairly solid. It's not that as people get larger, they tend to find other large people to be friends. It's rather that if a person is friends with somebody and that somebody starts gaining weight, the person A starts gaining weight if they're close friends. There was a study, and I referenced this in one of my books back about a decade ago. In fact, I don't even remember which book I wrote about it. It was one of my ADD books. But there was a fascinating study done on squirrels. Squirrels build nests, principally out of leaves, and they typically are a standard size. And this was, they were looking at, as I recall, gray squirrels somewhere in the Midwest. And, you know, there's all these different trees in the forest or in the community, and that had squirrels nests in them. And the squirrels nests all tended to be pretty much of the same size. And so what the scientists did is they went up and they increased the size of one of the squirrels' nests by, you know, 25-30%, just went up and added a whole bunch of leaves to it and made it bigger. And what they found was that over the course of the next few months, other squirrels within about a one-mile radius increased the size of their nests. Now, you know, what does this have to do with economics and the possibility of a, you know, disastrous economic crash here in the United States? Well, here's what it is. Squirrels are social animals just like we are. Squirrels are mammals like we are. They share the limbic brain, that part of the brain that evolved, you know, post-reptiles. And all, you know, virtually all mammals, particularly all social mammals, have this tendency to do as the group does. In fact, it's even possible that there's a strong evolutionary basis for this, that if one or some small number of squirrels in the community detects that a really intense winter is coming, they build their nest bigger, and other squirrels say, oh, well, hey, it must be a heavy winter's coming, dangerous winter, we need to build our nest bigger. It might be the same way with humans. It might be that there's some deep biological, neurobiological trigger in there that says, okay, you're storing up fat for famine time, and we know, I think, with some reasonable certainty now, that becoming very overweight actually is, you know, can track back to times of famine. And in fact, it was those, you know, we are the survivors of people who survived famines, who had the gene for being overweight when the famine hit and they could make it through it, or at least that's one of the arguments that's made. And so it may be that the neurobiological mechanism here isn't just, as Dr. Christakis, Nicholas Christakis of Harvard Medical School suggested, he said, you change your idea of what is an acceptable body type by looking at the people around you. It may be much deeper than that. It may be that at some deep level of our brains, at some deep survival level of our brains, we notice when other people are preparing for lean times, for famine, by adding body weight, and we start adding body weight. Now, the same could be said to be true for homes. But who are the Joneses? See, ultimately, the squirrel story is about keeping up with the Joneses. And in a way, I think that this obesity study is about keeping up with the Joneses. So with regard to our spending, our individual economic practices, and then how this translates into national economic practices, who are the Joneses? Well, before television, I mean, my parents got a TV when I was 4, 5, 6 years old. Well, I was must have been 4 or 5 years old when I was fairly young, which, you know, 4 years old, it would have been 1955, I guess. And before that, the Joneses were entirely the people who lived on either side of us and across the street from us. And frankly, throughout my childhood, through my life, I always measured myself by those folks. In 1956, my dad paid $12,000 for the house that he lived in until he died last year. And, you know, it wasn't a poor house, and it wasn't a mansion. It was, you know, a three-bedroom, one-bathroom house. And I always thought that that was just the normal thing. That, you know, looked around, hey, that's normal. My nest is the same as everybody else's nest. Because it was in a neighborhood of houses like that. And then on TV, TV came along in the 50s and the 60s, and it was Jackie Gleason and I Love Lucy, and the other apartments and the other homes that we were seeing were, you know, Jackie Gleason in his Coldwater walk-up apartment flattened and Lucy in a normal apartment. And we saw, the middle class saw the middle class on TV. And in the 80s, during the Greed is Good era, during the Reagan era, there was a startling, at least it was startling to me, a startling change in television. And you started seeing people, the stars of the sitcoms, you started seeing the shows. Dynasty, I suppose, was probably, you know, the late 70s was one of the first big examples. But you started seeing people living not in average middle class houses, but instead in multi-million dollar houses. In houses in, you know, on the beach in Santa Monica, in fancy houses. You had, you know, there was just this significant change from the old Dick Van Dyke and the early Mary Tyler Moore show stuff to Kelsey Grammer living up, you know, in a fancy penthouse up in Manhattan, multi-million dollar apartment. And so what happened was, as the Joneses became fancier and fancier, Americans recalibrated their notion of what they needed in order to keep up with everybody else, and they went into debt to do it. And last year, we had the first year of net negative savings rate since the Great Depression. At the same time, we had seen 26 years of this war on the American middle class, certainly on organized labor, by the Reagan administration. And at the same time, on top of that, our government, starting with Reagan, in large part in 1981, began a policy of moving away from spending for things with tax dollars to spending for things with borrowed dollars, just like we were with our houses. And now it's coming home to roost. I'll tell you how right after the break. Stick around.
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
Just come on.
21 minutes past the hour. So here's the Dow is down right now over 200 points, about 2%. This is the, you know, the big news. And a lot of people scratching their heads going, why is the Dow falling? Why is the Dow Jones Industrial Average dropping when corporate profits are so high? Well, a few corporations weren't doing so well, but why? Well, if you look at the screaming headlines in today's Financial Times, the Financial Times of London or the Wall Street Journal, it is that this debt bomb that was created by a combination of a failure of regulation in the United States of our banking and investment systems that encouraged people to go out and borrow and to buy far more house than they could afford, to borrow to buy far more automobile car than they could afford. You know, I had a conservative on the program say, all right, the economy's great. Just look at all these houses. Look at all these cars. Everybody's driving a brand new car out. Yes, and they're up to debt in their eyeballs, to their eyeballs. You see the commercial on TV, you know, what are they? They're debt relief agencies and credit consolidation agents. This is a symptom of a larger problem. And it's a problem that we're doing as a nation as well. Again, we're all making our nests larger or whatever, or we're all becoming contagiously obese in our debt, as it were. And the screaming headlines are about how the Chrysler deal, Chrysler was going to be bought out. Daimler Chrysler. Daimler was going to sell it off to Cerebras Capital Management, 80%. And there was another deal, and this is the one that Boots, which is the British equivalent of kind of Walgreens. It's the biggest chain of drugstores in England. This was another multi-billion dollar buyout. And both of these things were supposed to happen. And here's the headline from the Financial Times today. They were supposed to happen today. Chrysler and Boots deals hit debt block. Banks run into trouble selling loans. Credit crunch fears as fewer investors step up. Here's the bottom line. These guys wanted to, they had investors who wanted to buy these companies. They had companies that wanted to sell, but the investors couldn't buy them with their own money. They had to borrow money. So in order to borrow money, they went out to the credit markets. They went out to investors all over the world. And they said, we will sell you IOUs, bonds. We will sell you IOUs if you will, you know, buy them. In other words, if you will loan us the money, we will pay it back at a good interest rate. And then we're going to use that money to buy Chrysler. We're going to use that money to buy Boots. It's sort of like you or me going to a bank and saying, you know, I want to buy a house. Please loan me some money. And they couldn't raise the money. They just plain old flat out couldn't raise the money. In fact, it was essentially a disaster. The financing for the Alliance, Boots, and Chrysler buyouts, this is from today's Financial Times, two of the biggest private equity-backed deals in the markets ran into serious difficulties yesterday, intensifying fears about the possibility of a credit crunch. See, if there's a credit crunch, then really nasty things happen to the economy. It reduces what's called liquidity, the amount of money floating around. Well, a radical reduction of liquidity is the fancy way that economists describe what happened in 1929 in the United States. And it lasted all the way up through the middle of the 1930s, arguably to the end of the 1930s. The news affected equity markets, that's stock markets. There are fears tight credit conditions could derail a buyout boom that has boosted stock values on the assumption that a bid for nearly any company could be imminent. Now, here's where it gets just mind-boggling. The eight banks who are trying to sell $9 billion worth of loans for Boots, this was the biggest buyout in the history of the United Kingdom, threw in the towel on trying to place $5 billion in senior loans and only sold $1.75 billion of more junior debt at far bigger discounts than expected. In fact, the discounts were so high, they wiped out the 2 to 2.5% fees, leaving the banks with sizable losses. In other words, they had to say to the people who were loaning the money, it's like you go to the bank and say, you know, I want to buy a house, and they we'll loan you the money. We're going to make some money on the loan. Well, they lost money on these loans, and they couldn't raise enough money from the borrowers. Now, here's the bizarre flip side of this. On the same page in the Financial Times, a headline on the other side of the page, Chinese insurers can invest $50 billion overseas. Beijing raised the limits for overseas investment by Chinese insurance companies yesterday, potentially making up to $50 billion available. Chinese insurers have a combined $2.5 trillion, or $330 billion in assets, a total growing at 25 to 30% a year. And now it gets even weirder. Over in the Wall Street Journal, Angela Merkel of Germany is saying, but, you know, China's got all this money. We can't even borrow money. They're coming over to Germany and they're buying our companies in our country. And we don't think that that should happen because we're selling off our valuable and national infrastructure. But the Italians and the British are so hungry for money, so desperate for money, they're saying, nah, we're not going to put any protectionist barriers in the way. So China may end up owning the world. 27 minutes past the hour.
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
That's what democracy is for. The world looks to us to remember who we are, to be that shining light once more. Oh, it's up to us, it's up to you.
America,
stand up for the America we knew.
Take our country back.
Take it all the way.
We've got to take our country back. And we need to pay for it once again, by the way. Since Reagan became president, almost 14,500 companies, over $1.7 trillion worth of American business, American assets, have been sold to foreign corporations. Why? Because we're buying more stuff from overseas than we're selling to them, so they're ending up with a surplus of dollars. Where do they spend those? Here. They buy us. So we have been borrowing like crazy. We have been engaging in insane trade policies. And then Bush comes into office and says, I'm going to do the same thing Ronald Reagan did. Ronald Reagan ran up more debt in his 8 years as president than every president from George Washington until Ronald Reagan had combined. More debt than George Washington used to fight the Revolutionary War. More debt than in the War of 1812. More debt than the Civil War. More debt than World War I, the Spanish-American War, World War I, World War II, the Korean War, the Vietnam War. All of that combined, Ronald Reagan borrowed more money than that. And George W. Bush has now borrowed more money than Ronald Reagan did. And he says, oh, look at the great economy. You give me a credit card with $1 million or a $5 million line of credit on it that I don't have to pay, that my kids' grandchildren are going to pay or that my kids are going to pay, I could show you what it looks like to live large. It doesn't mean I'm actually doing it with any, you know, foundation. And in fact, it puts us all at tremendous risk. There's just an absolutely brilliant blog from Byron Williams over at Huffington Post yesterday. Debtor is as debtor does. Byron Williams, he says, in 1956, President Eisenhower learned after the fact that Britain, France, and Israel had invaded Egypt. The president was not pleased about this news and took immediate and decisive action. He instructed the Federal Reserve to orchestrate a run on the pound, the British currency, the British pound, and block the International Monetary Fund from stabilizing the currency, the pound. In fact, the Brits were so desperate for money at that point. The Straits of Suez had been blockaded, I mean, by the Egyptians. They were so desperate for money. They were trying to borrow money. We wouldn't loan it to them. And the pound was collapsing. And because we wouldn't help them out, we wouldn't help them in their currency crisis. And in fact, what Eisenhower was doing was he was dumping pounds. He was selling pounds. The British had to pull out of Egypt, and they pulled out of Egypt without telling the French and the Israelis that they were going to do it, which really upset the French and the Israelis. Anyhow, Byron Williams says one of the lessons learned from this, because they had to, because we had them absolutely by the throat economically. What Byron Williams says is, one of the lessons learned from this rather dubious affair, there can be no independent foreign policy if someone else controls your currency. And we are now in the position where we no longer control our currency, and they're in the process of selling off our country as well. It's time that Americans, you know, really started paying attention to just, you know, basic Econ 101. I mean, we've just got to get there. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number, TomHartmann.com, AirAmerica.com for our blog, TomHartmann.com if you want to drop into our live chat room. Eric in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Eric.
Hey, how you doing, Tom? First, I wanted to thank you for writing The Prophet's Way, which I read this past year at a particularly transformative time in my life, and it really helped a lot.
Well, thank you. The second week of September, I'm going to Germany back to Salem, which is what that book is about, and to see Herr Müller, and he's still alive. He's 93 now, and there's a link on my website about it. SalemInternational.org is the website. Anyway, as you were saying.
Okay, so the comment I wanted to make was this. You know, I was listening to your conversation with Bob Barr, and anytime I pick up the newspaper or turn on the TV or read polls in USA Today or whatever, the fact that I try to deny, and that's always brought home to me, is that as a progressive liberal, I am in the minority. And as much as I feel put upon, I feel marginalized, I want to pull my own hair out in astonishment at what our government's doing, what our corporations are doing, and what I think are, I guess, the inadequate responses by, I don't know, you know, everyone around me. I'm in the minority, and this is how
we're not, though.
Yes.
You're not, though. I mean, when Zogby, I mean, serious reputable polling agencies go out and ask Americans, would you be willing to pay more taxes to have national health care? Over 65% say yes. When they ask Americans, would you want to have the ability, if in your current job, if you could join a union by simply signing a card, would you do it? Well over, as I recall, over three quarters. I know certainly well over half say yes. The vast majority of Americans say yes. I mean, just go right on down. Would you be willing to pay higher taxes if it meant a cleaner environment, safer water, safer food? The vast majority of Americans say yes. On all these issues, by and large, you know, do you want Social Security to be stabilized, even if it means paying higher tax? Yes. It's right across the board. Americans would much rather live like Sweden than they would like to, live like Colombia or Mexico.
Right, and I think that, you know, that sort of goes back to what you were talking about with the squirrel study. I mean, you know, there's the common sense of the individual, but, you know, you have this whole echo chamber, and if you look at where the majority of our fellow citizens get their news, get their information, get their supposed facts, they get it from the mainstream media that spouts the same corporate, you know, baloney, and you know, it seems like sometimes we're preaching to the choir, that it's really not having that much effect, and that the only way to rouse people from their apathy is when it really hits them in the pocketbook. And I guess as a father of an 8-year-old boy, I worry about about his having to swim upstream all his life with the values that I try to teach him.
Yeah. Well, I agree with you, Eric, and I think we're all concerned about our children and our grandchildren, Louise and I keep hoping someday we'll have grandchildren, but in any case, about our children, certainly future generations. But here's the good news. The good news is that even though the vast majority of us are getting all this infotainment and nonsense and BS from the mainstream media about, you know, that has all these conservative subtexts to it, or sometimes overt text to it, the fact of the matter is that still, even in the face of that, the majority of Americans hold the values that are the traditional values of the Democratic Party and that are traditionally referred to as liberal, the values that were held by the founders of this country and the values that today are held by the most progressive among us. And I just see that as good news. Eric, I got to move along. Thank you for the call and thanks for your kind words. I appreciate it. John in Hollywood, California. Hey, John.
Hey, I just wanted to say that fear is what is behind all the conservative ideology as well as the overeaters ideology, because the main result or the main symptom of fear is greed, whether it's greed for food or greed for power. Look at Dick Cheney. He is both fat and powerful. But, you know, I want to say to everyone that this fear-based economy that we have has been around for ages. Whenever we're afraid of corn crop failing.
Well, and it, I mean, you know, arguably it goes back to serfdom, to medieval, I mean, and all the way back to, you know, 7,000 years to Gilgamesh. But I think that the word greed, I have a concern about the word greed. I agree that there is a contagious sense of we've got to get ready for something, and whether it's at some very deep unconscious level or even a biological level, we need to get ready for the famine by adding weight to our bodies, or there's, you know, we need to take away liberties and give more power to the government because we're afraid of the terrorists, whatever, or that because we don't have national health care and we don't have a strong social security system, we need to make as much money as we can as fast as we can. I'm not sure I'd call that greed. Greed has a real negative connotation to it. And I think I certainly would never want to call somebody who is overweight greedy, or even somebody who is making a lot of money greedy, although there are some who are probably. But I think that it's something deeper, and it's something that we frankly lack a word for in our society, in our culture, and will probably be the subject, and probably has been actually, of you know, good psychological, in-depth psychological and sociological studies over the years. But
think the root word of greed is need, and greed, I think, is gross need, and it's over needy, and you're taking something more than you really need to survive. That's going to protect.
Yeah, I'll take that frame, and I think that that's a reasonable frame. It's just, you know, unfortunate that it's such a pejorative, you know, it's such a pejorative term. But thanks for the call, Melanie in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Melanie.
Yes, I am an insurance agent, Health and Life, and I was fortunate to go to a particular seminar getting my continuation education classes. And one gentleman lived in Canada for 30 years and wrote a book about the facts and fiction of the U.S. ailing health system. And number one, he had mentioned that Canada's going bust. Number two, one of the reasons the generic...
Canada's not going bust. Canada's not in debt like the United States is in debt.
I'm talking about specifically from the healthcare program that they have.
Their healthcare system is just fine. It's solvent. It's not as good as a lot of Canadians would like. And frankly, I think, you know, if we were to do it in this country, we could do it a heck of a lot better. A lot of European countries have done it a lot better than the Canadians are.
And
I don't think that we should.
European countries, but I'm specifically talking about Canadian. A lot of people compare Canadian healthcare, and they need to know that people wait for a year and a half for knee surgery, which is ridiculous.
For elective knee surgery. Non-critical knee surgery. If you have a critical need, you will be seen by a doctor the same day.
What do you term as critical? You know,
well, what the physician's term is critical, Melanie. I mean, the bottom line is that if you have a national health care service, if you have health care that is run by the government and the government is elected, and that's the key. If it's not a dictatorship, if it's a democracy, if the government is elected, and that health care system has substantial deficiencies, those people are not going to get reelected. It's not going to last very long. And frankly, I can't vote for the guy who's the CEO of my health insurance company. I can vote for my congressman. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Again, hurroo, hurroo. They're rolling out the guns again, hurroo. Kaboom. They're rolling out the guns again, but they'll never take my sons again. No, they'll never take my sons again. Johnny, I'm swearing to ya. President, we will say, hey, you, yes, you. And to Dick Cheney, we will say, hey, you, yes, you. And to the president, we will say, may God forgive you on Judgment Day. For your lies have cost so many lives. Our children mean nothing to you. President, we will say, hey, you, yes, you. And to the Dick Cheney, we will say, hey, you, Yes, you. And to the president we will say, may God forgive you on Judgment Day. For your lies have cost too many lives. The truth means nothing to you.
And tragically, it didn't. And it doesn't. But at least the Senate is now holding Gonzo to account. We'll see if they hold the president to account. 9 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Frank in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Frank.
Hey, Tom, how are you?
I am great, but I'll get better. What's up?
Hey, thanks for an incredible show. I've tried to get on several times. It's been a little hard, but you're that popular, and you have an incredibly good perspective on laying out the facts, and you're the messenger.
Appreciate all the kind
of
words, Frank, but let's get right to our – what's the question or the comment?
Well, the thing I was calling about, actually, is there are this Gonzalez thing, and there's blogs out there for his impeachment. There's websites out there for his impeachment, as there are for Bush and as there are for Cheney. And I've noticed various entities that are posting these impeachment sites, and there doesn't seem to be a cohesive effort for a march on Washington and an impeachment process. And I'm just wondering if there's anything that can be done by the public other than calling your member of Congress for these efforts towards impeaching the whole gang.
Yeah. Well, that's where it has to start. It has to start actually in the House of Representatives. And although, you know, you want to get as many senators on board as you can, the probabilities of conviction in the Senate at this point are probably quite small. But it bills of impeachment start in the House of Representatives, because an impeachment is not a removal from office. It's an indictment. And so the House indicts, and then the Senate holds a trial and either convicts or acquits. So, for example, Bill Clinton was indicted, but he was acquitted. Same is true of Andrew Johnson. So that's how it would happen. But I think that there's a larger issue here, Frank, and I appreciate your calling and raising it, because I'd like to riff on it for just a second. And that is that in Michael Moore's movie, Sicko, he made the point that in France, the people are afraid of the government the government is afraid of the people. The people are regularly out. I mean, they're out in the streets. That the smallest thing the government does that they don't like, you know, they cut back on unemployment by 0.5% or something like that. You know, unemployment. And boom, you've got 100,000 people in the streets of Paris. They shut down the city. They shut down the country. They're in Germany right now. You've got the railroad workers, the train conductors and the train engineers holding a strike or threatening a strike. It doesn't happen in the United States. Why is it that all across Europe you have countries where the governments are afraid of their people and therefore responsive to their people, and in the United States you have a country where the people are afraid of their government and the government is therefore not as responsive to the people? And a lot of people have been scratching their heads about this and asking why. Why is it that Europeans protest in the streets and Americans don't? And I believe the answer is quite simple, and that a lot of us have been confusing cause and effect. That the reason Americans are not out in the streets is because Americans don't, at this point in time, unlike in the 1960s and 70s, at this point in time, Americans don't feel safe and secure in their own personal lives. Back in the 60s and 70s, when people were out in the streets, they knew that if they lost their job, they could get another job. They knew, because students knew, if they got thrown out of college because they were protesting, they could get into another college. And for free, or for damn cheap. People knew that they had a certain level of security, that there was a backstop. There were good union jobs out there. I was back in Michigan over the weekend. I was talking with an old and dear friend of mine, Terry O'Connor, who used to be a business partner of mine. And he was telling the story of a friend he knew who used to work at Oldsmobile. And, you know, good union job. And the guy wanted a week's off vacation. He didn't have enough time in to get it. And they said, no, you can't have that week off. So he quit his job, took the week, and then got another job. I don't think it was back at Oldsmobile. It might have been at a steel plant or something. But just got another good union job at the end of the week. That's what it was. I mean, that was the economy in the 60s and 70s and early 80s. Reagan completely deconstructed that. Reagan and Bush and Clinton and Bush have completely deconstructed that with these international free trade deals, with the hostility toward unionization. We've got unions have gone from 25% of the workforce when Reagan came into office down to 7% of the private workforce, the non-governmental workforce now. People are afraid in the United States. And it's not that they're afraid of their government, although it looks that way because they don't stand up to their government. It's that they're afraid that they're one disease away from bankruptcy, that they're one job loss away from losing their home and their car and living on the streets, which would never happen in any developed European country or in Japan. And that's why Americans are not out in the street. And so to blame people, to blame Americans, say, well, you guys need to get out and protest. You know, you're just not you're not as brave as the French. Well, nonsense. We have been eviscerated. Our middle class has been shredded by 26 years of war on the middle class by conservatives in this government. And not just in the government, by conservatives in the press, by conservatives in the media, by conservatives in our social institutions. The entire conservative economic juggernaut has been aimed in large part at this one goal of disempowering average Americans so that the 60s will never happen again. 57 minutes past the hour.
You're in the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman on Air America Radio. To the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
And welcome back. By the way, if you want to hear the audio of our conversation with former Congressman Bob Barr, one of the guys who led the floor effort in the House of Representatives to impeach Bill Clinton, suggesting that Republicans now and Democrats should be considering impeaching George W. Bush. The audio is up over at 620kpoj.com, along with the audio from last week of both our conversations with Bruce Fein and Paul Craig Roberts. Time now for a Pap Attack! Mike Papantonio is with us. He is the co-host of Ring of Fire right here on Air America Radio, and also the founder of GoLeft.tv. Hey, Mike.
Tom, how are you?
I am just great. And this website of yours, GoLeft TV, seems to me like, and correct me if I've got this wrong, but it seems like it's the next logical step in the evolution of the Internet from just pure text to streaming video. It's like
Tom, I got to tell you something. You wrote the page in line on how we as progressives can get the message out there. I'll tell you that up front. You really did. You did such a great job kind of giving everybody the path that we should be taking. And so that's what GoLeft TV is. It's an extension of what we've tried to do with Air America, what you've been doing for just years and years. And I think the reason it's so successful is because there's a hole in the market. I mean, you've got, you've got the right-wing demagogue talkers out there that have flooded the market. Listeners have been O'Reilly'd and Hannity to death. And they want something else. And so there's this big hole in the market. And I think Go Left is just benefiting from that. I mean, it's been like a tsunami with interest in what we're doing.
Yeah, it's sort of as if the Drudge Report or the BuzzFlash, you know, the left-wing version of the Drudge Report, instead of having links to stories, you have video there, and people can link to the video.
Yeah, we're actually, most of it, as you can see, is original. It's all original content. It's not really like a YouTube or anything like that. We do have some of the content that's not ours, but we have arrangements with people like Heads Up that does some of the cartoons. But I mean, we're all over the place with the issues. I mean, we have the daily news, we have political commentary, we have short form documentaries, we have the environment, religion, labor. But I want to stress this enough because I think. That people who followed your career understand that you helped pave the way for this, and we read your stuff. When you wrote it, we read it, and we said, let's try it, and I'm glad we did, because it's just a staggering result that we're seeing here.
Well, thanks for your kind words, Mike. I'm curious. You're in a position to see Presumably, you're measuring, you're looking at your metrics. You're measuring what it is that people are watching on your website over at goleft.tv and noticing where their interest is. I've always been curious about, because I don't run a news website. I mean, I can tell you who's calling into the show and who's posting over on our message board. But what are the main topics that are getting the most interest right now at GoLeft TV?
Well, I think it comes down to it's daily news. Oddly enough, it's not an odd issue. I mean, it's no surprise, really. Our daily
tragically news, enough, really.
Yeah, it is tragic because you have to understand. People understand that they're not getting real news from mainstream media. So the daily news has been huge. When you go from there, for some reason, we're tapping into what seems to be a lot of anger out there right now. I've had something that I've done for years on Air America called the PATH attack. And it's nothing warm and fuzzy about it. It's pretty direct kind of stuff. They seem to be tapping into that. And Bobby Kennedy's issues are just on the environment are just so huge right now. But it's all over the spectrum. Even the progressive religion is something that, has quite a following. So it's hard to know why, well, we do know why. We know that this is kind of a backlash to what people have been fed from mainstream media for so long. But I got to tell you, I'm shocked at the result, to be very frank with you.
How well it's doing, how many people are coming into it?
Exactly.
Yeah. I am not. It's a great website, goleft.tv, and the content is solid, and that's a really useful and important thing. What do you see, Mike Papantonio? I mean, you're an attorney. What do you see as the best remedies right now for what's going on with this administration?
Well, I think the only way that you can get the real picture out to people, and we're kind of living in a 15-minute world on news, just by necessity. I think people working 2-3 jobs, they're inundated with all parts of the culture. And so the thing you have to do is you just have to shine the light on the same thing you've done for so long. And what we're able to do with GoLeft TV is to do exactly that. We can deliver the real message in about 15 minutes. And I think that's what scares this Republican administration. I don't know if you followed this or not, but the GOP is creating their own guidebook for candidates to tell them how to get on the internet and blog. I mean, the National Senatorial Committee has hired 2 press secretaries for blogger outreach. The bad news for them, and this is terrible news for them, and they know it, is that less than 8% of the people that are online activists, this whole new development of people called online activists, less than 8% now call themselves conservative Republican. See, here's the problem for them, Tom. They are listening in the red states. They're listening to Rush. They're listening to Riley and all of these people. But look at what happened last quarter fundraising. Obama raised $32 million out of about 150,000 separate donations that were largely driven by the internet. Now, so Johnny Bob can be listening to Rush Limbaugh about how bad liberals are and how we're killing democracy, but that doesn't translate into action by Johnny Bob. You see, he doesn't send his $25 check. When they go on the internet and they're it's interaction process, they're actually sending those checks in. A quarter of the people that describe themselves as internet activists posted their own political commentary on these blogs. They're young, they're wealthy, they're well educated, and they're mad as hell right now. So I think that's what we do. To answer your question, what we do is we keep chipping away at this message that we can deliver by way of the internet because we know it's effective. I mean, the votes are in on it, and we know that it's effective.
Yeah. So what's the next step, Mike?
Well, I think the next thing that we're trying to do is we're trying to make kind of a one-stop shop idea for progressive politics and progressive culture. There's a lot of video material out there, but if you were to go to something, for example, I guess YouTube is the best example. If you go to YouTube, it's all over the place. There's a lot of stuff. It's funny stuff. It's great entertainment. I love YouTube. But if you have 15 minutes and you want to know what it is that's happening in the world of the progressive world of politics, you want to go to one place. And so what we're trying to do is we're trying to build that in. And our next move is we're holding the first film festival, documentary Extraordinary Film Festival that's ever been held on the internet, and we're giving out serious money, $4,000.
That's a great idea.
Yeah, $4,000 for the first one that is longer than 20 minutes, $2,000 for one underneath 20 minutes. We're getting a huge result from that. But we want to do that in all parts of progressive culture. And you know, in the end, I'm proud to say that I'm a liberal progressive. That's why I didn't hide behind what we are. Go left is very clear. Go left means exactly that. You know what? If we just attracted the people who call themselves progressive liberals, that's all I'm interested in talking to anyway. I could care less. You know, you hear this thing, well, you have to talk to the middle, you got to talk to the right. No, I don't. I don't have the intention of doing that. And so, I it's very specific on who we want to talk to. It's nothing warm and fuzzy about us. We're not apologetic about anything we do. We go after the right wing as hard as they've been going after us for 12 damn years now. And so, you know, that's what Go Left is about. It's not for the NPR crowd. I think people that listen to NPR would be, they'd be a little bit jolted by some of the stuff that we see.
Well, the problem increases. Increasingly, is that now the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the majority of the heads of it are Republicans, partisan Republicans.
Yeah.
You know, the Bush administration politicizing public broadcasting. Plus, I mean, they outed ADM back 15 years ago or so, and which led to the largest antitrust settlement in the history of the U.S. government against ADM. And as I recall, it was antitrust.
Yes, it was.
And all of a sudden, ADM starts advertising on public broadcasting. And all of a sudden, there's no more outing of big corporations.
Exactly.
I just, you know, I think a lot of people have become very disillusioned, frankly, with public
broadcasting. Well, when you started talking the talk that you have made so popular, the talk you invented, when you started that, Tom, years ago, you understood you were talking to an audience that was hard to get through to. Now your audience is it's a different audience. It's a different audience.
It's growing. It's growing for all of us here. Yeah, and it's a good thing. Mike Papantonio, he's the co-host of Ring of Fire, the founder of Go Left TV, goleft.tv. Great website and a great URL. Mike, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Great work you're doing. And say hi to Bobby. He's one of my heroes, doing great work also. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception on Air America Radio.
It's past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you on Air America Radio. Christy Harvey is with us. She is the research director at the Center for American Progress and serves as editor of thinkprogress.org. Excuse me. She's the director of strategic communications at the Center for American Progress and creates the daily news prep site, miccheckradio.com, americanprogress.org, the Center for American Progress's main website. And it's our Under the Radar segment here. Christy, welcome to the program.
Hey, how are you? It's okay. We all sort of do everything over here at the center. So.
Multiple hats.
Exactly.
Well, I'm curious, what are you seeing, what are you finding that is flying under the radar of the mainstream media and perhaps even to some extent of the progressive media that we need to know about today?
Well, I just saw this really scary story this morning about one of those crazy, crazy right-wing groups that loves to get into your bedrooms and into your personal life. This one is called the Family Foundation. And, Tom, you may remember them from last year. They were very famous for being the group in Virginia who got the Congress to push through a state amendment to the Constitution saying that gays can't marry. Mm-hmm. So they checked that off of their checklist and got sort of bored, I guess, and thought, so who else can we try and stop from marrying? And they decided to turn their sights on straight people.
Whoa.
So they have, are equal opportunity people like that.
Let me just get this straight.
Uh-huh.
Originally, they were saying that they were opposed to gay marriage because they thought it was hurting the institution of straight marriage. Now they're going after, I don't get it. What am I missing here?
they want to make it much harder to get married and to get divorced. And so they're coming up with all of this new legislation saying that before you get married, they want the state to pass a law saying before you get married, you have to go through so much couples counseling. Before you get divorced, you have to have this kind of waiting period and go through other kinds of counseling.
There's at least a certain internal consistency to their logic. I mean, I remember the first time I went to Ireland must have been in the mid-70s or thereabouts, maybe the late 70s or early 80s. And rented a car at the airport, and I'm driving toward Dublin, and there's this giant billboard, and it's got a picture of a mother and a daughter, and the daughter has these big tears in her eyes. She's obviously, you know, very, very sad picture. And the headline, just this huge headline, said, "Don't let it happen to them." And then at the very bottom, it said, "Vote no on Proposition 12," or, you know, whatever it was.
Right.
And I couldn't figure out, what is this? So when I got to Dublin, I was sitting in a pub with some folks. And I said, "What's the deal with these billboards I'm seeing all over the place that say vote no on this thing?" And they said, "Oh, well, they put it on the ballot to decriminalize divorce or to legalize divorce." Because at that point, it was illegal in Ireland, and this was the late 70s or early 80s, to get divorced. And, in fact, it passed, and now you can get divorced in Ireland. But I guess if you're, you know, gung-ho on making sure that marriage lasts forever, then and you believe that the force of law, you know, invading people's bedrooms and controlling people's private lives is the way to do it, then at least these guys have some internal consistency to their weird logic.
Well, that's the problem I have with it, though, is, I mean, who really wants, I mean, you've seen some legislators and some congressmen and some senators, who really wants those outside people telling you if your marriage is good enough or strong enough or if you need to stay in it?
Right.
I think that this is really bad, especially because it's going to make it harder for women to leave abusive relationships. And honestly, think about what some of the big strains on marriage are. It's money and things like that. You know, wouldn't it be easier to help people stay together if, you know, you pumped up the minimum wage a little bit or, you know, got some people some decent health care and took away some of those stresses? But no.
I'm not supporting these guys. I'm just saying at least they're internally logically consistent. But there's still whack jobs. I mean, they're just completely out there.
Oh, and marriage is important, but I get creeped out when people really want to know what's going on in my life. You know what I mean? When they want to make laws to sort of control.
Well, this is the fundamental difference between conservative morality and liberal morality. Conservatives are concerned about, you know, what are you doing in your bedroom? And who are you doing it with? And in what position? And what are you smoking? And liberals are concerned about, are there hungry among us? Are there sick among us? Are there homeless among us? You know, liberal morality is concerned with what's happening in public, what we're all collectively doing. And conservative morality is concerned with what individuals are doing in private.
You know, I think that's a great point.
It's that Michael Moore's, you know, me society versus we society. And the conservatives are all about the me society. So, of course, they want to know what's that me of you doing, you know, with that kind
right,
of
thing. Right.
So, got about a minute left. What else is out there, Christy?
This is some good news, actually. The Fort Lewis military base in Washington was going to actually stop having individual funerals for soldiers killed in Iraq because there's so many being killed. And instead, they wanted everybody to hold off and have a group funeral at the end of every month. And, of course, military families were horrified and really just disgusted at this news. And so the base finally changed its mind this morning and said that they forget it. They will continue to have individual funerals for those troop members who lose their lives in Iraq and Afghanistan. So, you know, I think if there's too many soldiers being killed to actually have individual funerals, maybe you want to rethink the war strategy.
Yeah. Yeah,
that
would be a very good place to start. And all the more the tragedy that has been visited on us by this administration. Christy Harvey, AmericanProgress.org, the Director of Strategic Communications at the Center for American Progress. Christy, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
It's always great having you on. 27 minutes past the hour is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. You want to participate in our blog, go over to airamerica.com. Message boards over at tomhartman.com. In our live chat room, you'll find links to the live chat room from both.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Yeah, or let's go out and take it. Let's just take it back. We're going to take back this country. It's going to happen. And there's a whole lot of folks out there working on it. God bless them all. And a lot of them are doing it on the Internet. We have with us today Faz Shakir of thinkprogress.org. He's the research director for the Center of American Progress, Center for American Progress, and serves as editor of thinkprogress.org and the Progress Report, thinkprogress.org, great blog. And Ron Breinert, who is here with the news you don't get from Fox News, CNN, or MSNBC over at rawstory.com. And Ron and Faz, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, great to have you both. Ron, let me start out with you. What are you seeing over there at rawstory.com that's, you know, by and large and pretty much not being covered in the mainstream media? What do you see as the biggest stories of this week?
The biggest stories of this week? Well, right now, of course, it's back to Alberto Gonzalez and Attorneygate and all that. That's pretty much getting the coverage everywhere. One of the things that Raw Story's been covering a lot that I don't see anywhere else is all the congressmen that are signing on to the Kucinich, Peach, Cheney thing. And there was just someone yesterday that signed on. I don't remember who right now. Sorry. Have to check. But that is something definitely that I don't see any coverage anywhere. And maybe, you know, you have the leaders in Congress like Pelosi or Reid downplaying that there's any chance of that happening. But honestly,
I don't think most Americans know that Dennis Kucinich has even introduced this legislation.
No, I'm sure they don't. I mean, it's hardly gotten any coverage at all. I think it's now up to 16 official, and there may be as many as 19 or 20 that said they would sign it but haven't yet for whatever reason.
Yeah.
So that's certainly one thing. And I don't understand, it, with all the emphasis on all the investigation and everything else and the probing, it just seems like that's just a natural combination for the media to cover, but they're not. And, of course, it's probably because of the powers that be in Washington and the Dems not really going along with it yet. But
yeah, there's an institutional resistance to the idea that just is bizarre, but it's very much there. Faz Shakir over at thinkprogress.org, the Think Progress, the Center for American Progress's blog, what are you seeing as the biggest stories right now here?
Oh, well, you know, everything that's going on with the Senate Judiciary Committee is very interesting, very disturbing, and will continue to play out, I think, over the next couple weeks. So there's one is, of course, this the issues over Gonzalez's testimony and how they sort that out going forward. Today, of course, we heard Chuck Schumer and a number of other senators say that they want a special counsel. And so I think that, of course, will fall out into next week, and we'll see if we get any traction. I think, you know, judging by what Arlen Specter has said in this past, he would be a candidate who might be willing to join that effort. So it will be interesting to see what Specter says about that. The other one, of course, is today with Leahy issuing the Rove subpoenas. White House will, of course, resist. But the issue all along has been that whether Congress can get access to a transcript. There hasn't really been issues about whether he'll appear. They've been willing to put him up. But the issue is whether they can get a transcript out of it. So maybe the subpoenas changes the dynamic around that question.
Is the subpoena by Leahy, does it stand alone as a subpoena, or does it require some action by the Senate as a whole or the committee as a whole? I mean, is it a done deal that a subpoena has been issued to Karl Rove, or is this the initiation of a process that could lead to a subpoena?
It's a done deal. It's out. They've already they voted for it. They issued these two subpoenas. You remember they had already voted for it a while back. The Senate
they authorized that.
They authorized it, exactly.
And right, so this is the actual execution.
Waiting until it was executed, and today was the day that Leahy chose to do that.
Right. Now, where do you think that this is going to go?
Well, I think judging from what has happened with Myers' testimony versus that of Sarah Taylor and Harriet Myers, you know, they've chosen two very different courses. Sarah Taylor, of course, left the White House and was of her own volition, and she chose to appear. And I think that the experience from that, I would gather from inside the White House, was that, well, that didn't go so bad as we thought. Of course, I think it was because she didn't really have the keys to the kingdom. Karl Rove does. So maybe they don't want to go through that with Karl Rove. On the other side, you have Harriet Myers, who resisted. And now she is under, you know, intense legal assault, really, from the House Judiciary Committee and others. And she might be challenged in court. And so I think she's only created more problems for herself. Sarah Taylor, I think, has alleviated many problems. So I would hope that, judging from that experience, the White House looks at a different calculus as to how it wants to play this out.
Interesting. Ron Breinhardt over at rawstory.com. Ron, I'm just curious, first of all, your take on Sarah Taylor's testimony. It seemed to me that there was just a mind-boggling amount of I don't remember and I don't know, which on the one hand avoids a perjury charge if you false, you know, say something false like Gonzo apparently did yesterday, and on the other hand avoids you know, a failure to testify if you simply say I'm not going to say, or, you know, pleading the fifth essentially. But isn't there a certain point where Congress says, hey, wait a minute, we know you know this? Ron? Is Ron still there? Ah, I'm not hearing Ron. Nope. Let me toss this to Faz. I can't hear Ron at all, and so I'm assuming he's not on the board.
Yeah, on the Sarah Taylor question, you know, another interesting angle about that. Of course, you were absolutely right about her previous testimony, which was that it was full of I don't know and I don't recall and I can't remember, and anything that was of substantive value to the committee, she just couldn't remember, and all the talking points from the White House were constantly refreshed in her memory, and she could utter them with ease, but right, nothing of substance. The other thing I just wanted to note on her is that, you know, Robert Novak said that in his column today that she is going to be talking with the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee today, tomorrow, actually. I take that back. Tomorrow, on Friday, she'll be going and giving a deposition there, and that's regarding the politicization of the Office of National Drug Control Policy. You've been following the story.
Yes.
They sent a lot of aides out to different battleground states and used, you know, these policy aides and buried
the drug czar's office, basically, was
right,
using their federal office in violation of the Hatch Act to promote Republican candidates.
And, of course, the Office of National Drug Control Policy wasn't alone in doing that. We've learned that it extended all throughout the executive branch. It's a favored practice. So she'll be going before Waxman's committee to just talk to them and give a deposition tomorrow. And Novak reports that deposition tomorrow will be in preparation for open testimony perhaps on Monday. So we may be looking at another Sarah Taylor testimony on Monday, which would be in a different sphere, kind of a different sphere from her previous testimony, because that was largely about the attorney scandal. This one is taking it more into, as you said, the Hatch Act violations and what was the political office trying to do and how they politicized the various agencies and departments.
Right. We're talking with Faz Shakir, thinkprogress.org, the blog over at the Center for American Progress. And we were talking with Ron Breinhardt over at rawstory.com. We seem to have lost the phone line there. And Faz, I'm curious, what do you see coming down the road? What are the stories that are actually out there and might be being noticed but aren't really getting the attention that they should? What are the sleepers?
I mean, that's a hard one. I think that there's at least one today that I think caught my attention. I don't know if it's not coming down the road, but I think that this whole issue could be something that's larger, and that's this U.S. embassy in Baghdad. You know, there's a whole lot of issues that surround it. What Waxman?
You're talking about the report on Bechtel today.
Well, there's a report on Bechtel. That's one aspect of it. There's all these different branches off it. The one that the Waxman's committee is looking at today is the construction of the embassy and how they've found labor. And they had a witness testify today, and that witness said that slave labor was used to construct the U.S. embassy. He said people were kidnapped by First Kuwaiti, the contractor, and they were forced to work at the U.S. embassy. They were told to board planes. They didn't know where they were going. They were shipped to Baghdad, and they were told to work on the U.S. embassy. So that is an explosive charge and something of, I think, think we should all be concerned about. But I think even larger than that, the general construction of the embassy, what its role will be, how that relates to permanent bases in Iraq. There's a lot of questions that surround it, and there's, I think, in general, a greater resentment. My feeling is that looking at the press reports about it, there's a greater resentment building in Iraq to the embassy because as we get closer to the withdrawal and more consolidation around some troops need to come home, they're looking at the embassy and watching this spectacular thing being constructed, and they're saying they're not going anywhere.
It's like the Palace of the Versailles, or one of the summer homes of Louis and Marie Antoinette. I mean, it's
On that point, did you see Michelle Bachmann? Is that her name? Bachmann, this congresswoman from Minnesota. Did you see her comments? She just came back from Iraq.
Yeah, she said it's like the Mall of America.
It's like the Mall of America, because clearly she saw the embassy and thought it was wonderful.
Absolutely bizarre. Yeah, we talked about that yesterday. In fact, I saw it over at thinkprogress.org. Faz Shakir, thinkprogress.org, the website. He's the research director at the Center for American Progress. Faz, thanks for being with us.
Thanks a lot, Tom. It's great.
And thanks also to Ron Breinert from rawstory.com for participating. 45 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain. On Air America Radio. Call 866-303-2270.
Hey, America, time to wake up. Get involved. By the way, just a special hey out there to Ron Winnick. Ron Winnick is visiting us in the studio today, a small businessman here in Portland who does some really amazing gift stuff. You can check it out on the web, Ron, W-I-N-N-I-C-K.com. RonWinnick.com is his website. Ellen Ratner with us on the line here from Talk Radio News, Talk Radio News Service, TalkRadioNews.com in Washington, D.C. Hey, Ellen.
Well, hello. I know you've been talking a little bit about the Gonzales issue and the perjury probe and the Senate committee subpoenas on Rove and his deputy, but before we get back to that, let me just give you a couple other new things that have just come in. Secretary of Defense Robert Gates today is trying to ramp down what's going on between the Pentagon and Senator Clinton, and he essentially sent a 3-page letter to Senator Clinton saying that he regretted that the important discussion went astray, and he regretted any misunderstanding of intention, and he agreed with her that planning concerning the future of the U.S. forces in Iraq, including drawdown of the forces at the right time, is appropriate and essential. And he said that planning is taking place with his active involvement.
Well, that's interesting. Now, just for those people who may not know the background of this, Senator Clinton had sent a letter to the Pentagon saying, do you guys have contingency plans for withdrawing from Iraq? And if so, would you please share them with me on a secure, confidential basis? And what she got back was a letter from some apparently political hack in the Pentagon who said, you're helping the terrorists by asking these kind of questions, essentially.
And then she sent a letter to them, and actually she sent a letter back to Gates. She avoided the underling.
Right, yeah, and so now Gates is apologizing. Well, that's good.
Also,
what else is up?
The Senate Foreign Relations Committee held a hearing on extraordinary rendition today. It was actually chaired today by Senator Biden, and he said that extraordinary rendition has undermined our moral credibility and standing abroad, and he said, furthermore, we continue to pursue our rendition program ungoverned by law. And he said that we can have both a good rendition program and have this program governed by law and have the things together that would increase our credibility.
And did they call witnesses? I mean, was there anything done other than
they had
Biden?
Was the a guy from the Washington Advocacy Directory for Human Rights Watch. Philip Zelikow, or he is the professor of history at the University of Virginia. The Washington Advocacy Director for Human Rights said that the first excuse that they use is the whole world is a battlefield in an open-ended war on terror. He said the second excuse is that terrorists could be caught and detained at any time or any location. Zelikow said that the United States has an obligation to protect its citizens when it comes to deciding where they will send captured terrorists, because that ultimately protects the citizens, because otherwise people think every American is fair game.
So if the entire world is a battlefield, then you and I right now are living on a battlefield, and we're no longer subject to the Constitution of the United States. We're subject to the laws of war.
That is the exact logical conclusion to what the Bush administration would like us to believe.
That's what Republican Bruce Fine on this program pointed out last Wednesday, was a solid basis for the impeachment of George W. Bush and Dick Cheney, that assertion. He said that is a criminal assertion. And that's fascinating. So that was the administration was essentially defending that position before Biden's committee today.
Oh, essentially the administration I'm not sure how many administration people were there defending it, but essentially that has been the administration's complete defense always, that, you know, we're on a war on terror, and it is, as they always say, a global war on terror.
Yeah, which
gives them powers that were uneven, which the framers of the Constitution couldn't have imagined in their wildest fantasy.
Well, even King George III, who we fought a revolution against, didn't say that he had a global war going on and he could go into France, for example, and kidnap people. I mean, even Napoleon never suggested. The emperors of Rome never suggested that.
Well, we have a whole new breed of cat going on here.
I guess so.
And as you know,
other news.
I've been talking about on the program, the perjury probe of Gonzalez. This is going to be very interesting because, of course, there you have it. There's a perjury probe of him. And who is going to really continue with this probe? They are really getting the support here. Harry Reid, he is very much behind this,
mm-hmm.
And also on the subpoena of Roe and the deputy, which is really amazing, is that Senator Leahy announced it on the Senate floor.
Why is that amazing?
Because usually that kind of thing is done at a press conference. It's unusual that you take your committee's vote and use it sort of as a speech on the floor. I mean, it gets a lot of attention. And we've had people do things such as D'Amato, having pink pigs on the Senate floor or pictures of them and talking about the budget. I mean, so people have done unusual things on the Senate floor, but it's more the kind of thing that is done on a press conference, usually not done on the Senate floor.
Interesting.
He used the opportunity, and I'm glad he did.
Right. Yeah. But essentially what he is doing is, instead of having the Senate, the sergeant at arms, go after Gonzalez, he's going to ask Gonzalez to investigate himself. I mean, the Department of Justice has to execute this, don't they?
That's right. And I don't know really what happens as far as I can tell, and I'm sure you've had people on your show, constitutionally what happens, this is going to be interesting, as they say.
Yeah, indeed.
May you live in interesting times, as the Chinese proverb says.
And we certainly do, Ellen Radner. Thanks a lot, Ellen. Ellen Radner with the Talk Radio News Service. Great talking to you today.
Thank you.
It's 56 minutes. Well, we're wrapping up the hour here. Tomorrow, Friday, anything goes Friday. Call in about anything. Plus, in our first hour, Senator Bernie Sanders here for Brunch with Bernie, taking your calls as he does every Friday at noon Eastern Time. The best of the rest of the news right here on the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People. Also, our Bob Barr interview is over at 620kpoj.com if you want to hear that. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it!
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.